Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am, of course, Chris Martinson, and today, very special guest. We have Charles Hugh Smith, who's been an independent journalist for over 20 years, and his excellent weblog, OfTwoMinds.com, that's OfTwoMinds.com, offers really very thoughtful, unique analyses of global finance, social themes, the political economy. And he's an accomplished author as well. Charles wrote the very prescient handbook, Survival Plus, Structuring Prosperity for Yourself and the Nation, which I highly recommend. I've read it. And has just finished another book, An Unconventional Guide to Investing in Troubled Times. Charles, you know, it's high time we've had you as an interview guest. Here you are. I'm really looking forward to our discussion today. Welcome.
Thank you, Chris. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, there's so much I want to talk with you about, especially with all that's going on these days. But let's start with your new book, if we could. Tell our listeners what it's about and why you decided to write it now.
Okay. I have been working on the book for 18 months for the reasons that are familiar with Chris Martinson readers and members, which is we all know the present is unsustainable. And so where can we put our resources, our capital, and our labor that will be productive as the status quo basically devolves or crumbles? And so the book, having come out in July, just happened to be good timing as the market is, in fact, crumbling as we speak.
Yes, it is.
And I think the basic thrust of the book is that the standard, the conventional investment advice that we typically hear is, well, we'll balance your portfolio between stocks and bonds and you know, overseas investing and domestic. And these, I don't think these metrics have any value anymore, or they've lost their meaning as all of the status quo investments start coming apart at the seams.
Mm-hmm. So your general thesis is we're on an unsustainable course, which for those who are new listeners may be a shorthand for the idea that the past couple of decades, maybe even four decades, have all been defined by the idea that we're going to grow debt and accumulation of debt at a faster pace than the underlying economy. That means really we're living on borrowed money. We're living beyond our means, however you want to look at that, at the nation level, whatnot. So you're just looking, are you looking just primarily through that first economic lens and just looking at it, declaring it unsustainable, and then saying, because of that, this is going to devolve, is the word you use, or shift or change. Is that the general macro landscape you're looking at?
Yes, Chris. And of course, I learned from the crash course about the unsustainability of that exponential rise in debt. But also, as you've covered in depth, we're running out of the idea that there's unlimited resources that we can exploit at ever greater rates of consumption. So peak everything, as we call it. That's also an issue. And also the unsustainability of a lot of our political and social structures that, you know, we've kind of grown fat and sassy and complacent based on this unlimited debt, which has allowed us to sustain things which are not sustainable. So there is definitely a social and political impact to the end of this kind of debt, cheap oil era.
So in your mind, what happens when that debt cycle ends, when the party's over, when it comes to the additional accumulation, exponential accumulation of more debt, which, by the way, they're trying very hard in Europe and in Washington, D.C. to perpetuate, keep that moving. Let's say they can't. What happens?
There will have to be a renunciation of debt on a vast scale, and it could take the form of a forgiveness of debt, meaning that we deal with it as adults and write it off, or it could be renounced in a very chaotic, unplanned way as people just default, and then that triggers a whole domino chain of the borrowers are defaulting, then of course the lenders become insolvent and they default on their counterparty obligations. And so then it becomes, it reaches the same point, the debt's written off.
But this would be a process of default. You know, the Fed's been fighting that tooth and nail. You know, we just found out through the FOIA request that Bernie Sanders put through that, you know, the Fed had put $18 trillion in cash and guarantees across the global landscape to prevent exactly what you're talking about from happening. By all measures, they kind of did. So what's to prevent the world central banks? By the way, we've had three interventionist central bank actions in the last 24 hours. So we're recording this on Thursday afternoon, August 4th, but we've seen the Swiss bank come in and essentially print like crazy. We've seen the ECB come in and buy, you know, intervene in the Italian bond auction. We've seen the Bank of Japan come forward and attempt to bring their currency down. With all this intervention, how is it possible what's the trigger for this wave of debt defaults in your mind?
Chris, I think we all sort of know that there's two sort of end states here. The end game is either we consciously renounce the debt or we get the hidden default of the currencies being wiped out in mm-hmm. terms of what they can buy. So if we do the hidden default method, then everyone will get their Social Security check for $1,200 and that'll buy them like a loaf of bread or something. And so the government will be fulfilling its obligations, but the purchasing power of the money that it's distributing will have been lost. And of course, we all know that's a possibility, and that's just another way of reaching the same point that the debt in the system will be purged either by either high inflation or hyperinflation or by a conscious renunciation. And that doesn't seem possible at the moment, a conscious renunciation, but there could be political changes, say, over the next 4 or 5 years that could bring that about if the people realize that's a better solution to a hidden default.
Right. Well, yes, it's possible. I find that history says hidden default is the preferred option by far.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
Okay.
But I like to at least address the possibility that we could choose more wisely, but, you know,
yes.
Not saying that's likely, but it's always possible.
Absolutely. So you wrote this book, and it's got Unconventional Guide to Investing in its title. What do you mean by unconventional investing here?
I mean that it looks at investing from the point of view of as a form of expression, of personal expression, if you will, which is completely outside the normal conventions where you simply seek the highest return from whatever mutual fund or the hot manager or hedge fund. But I think investing your capital, which includes your financial capital and also your human and your social capital, is actually a form of self-expression. And that as a trader myself, then I think the key to investing wisely is to align that with your own interests and your own personality. And a lot of people have expended a tremendous amount of time and energy and money trying to find the, quote, you know, perfect system which generates returns, you know, in all markets and this kind of stuff. And that kind of system doesn't exist. And statistically, there is simply no system or manager who outperforms over a 20-year period in both bull and bear markets. The number of people who do so is statistical noise.
Well, you would expect somebody's out at the end of that bell curve, of course. So I don't know that there are a statistically significant number of those people. They do exist. Some of them may well have some sort of proprietary mojo that's awesome. But you're right, those are very rare and few and far between. And this is a main theme of mine, which is that almost all of the methods for investing that we've grown up with, that you learn from your father, your grandfather, your mother, your grandmother, wherever you got this stuff from, your broker, doesn't matter. They're all predicated on this idea of these models and techniques and styles, all of which themselves are predicated on growth, which means that, you know, as long as we have this 3-5% economic growth with the occasional, you know, recessionary hiccup here and there, but long term, you could put a ruler on this thing and say, wow, there's an upward slope to this economic growth. That growth gives a lot of the value to the overall aggregated stock and bond and other financial paper-based assets. It's that growth that's just baked in, and it's so baked in that most people don't even consider it. You know, they're not aware of the extent to which the current prices and values of these things depend on that future growth happening. You know, so the correct question I think people need to ask if they insist on staying in the stock market is, what is the correct price earnings multiple for a company or a stock index which has 0% earnings growth baked into it? I'll give you a minute for that one, but it's lower than it currently is. Where do you place it?
Well, if we look at cycles and even if we just look at cycles and trends, then a lot of people are targeting an S&P around 450 or thereabouts, meaning a drop of two-thirds from here. That might work. But as you really, if you take what you just said and follow the implications, what if there's no earnings? In other words, what if oil goes to $200 a barrel and a trade war erupts as everyone tries to protect their own national resources and so on, what I call deglobalization starts kicking in, then it may be extremely difficult to make profits in any way. And so it may be that a period of really low profits would, of course, then bring very low stock values. And Chris, the other thing I would say about the unconventional side of what I'm describing in the book is to look at how we value enterprises in general, and to question the whole idea that it makes more sense to invest in a mine or a corporation 6,000 miles away than to seek out a mine or a company in our own, like, hometown, so to speak, or our home state or our home region that we can really understand, and that we would be drawing upon that productivity that we can understand, and we're not just trusting Wall Street to tell us this company 6,000 miles away is really a great thing.
Yes, you know, I come from a banking family. My great-great-grandfather founded one, and on the male side on that family, there's been somebody involved with it since. And they've been cranking out just excellent earnings all the way through this whole hiccup. And I had opportunities to warn them this hiccup was coming, and they looked at me and they said, "Look, we know every single person on our balance sheet. Every asset on here is somebody we know. We're intimately familiar with all the businesses. We don't, you know, here's our credit standards." They just run it like my grandfather used to run it, which is just incredibly safe and sound. And with that intimate local knowledge, and guess what? They've come through this period just fine. As we get into this next period, though, if I understand you correctly, and I think I do, there's going to be an even higher premium on really knowing where your money is and what it's doing, because the easy returns of just anonymously tossing your money over a wall towards a group of people who are going to manage it for you, let's call that Wall Street for now. When things get tight, one of my basic theories in life is that when there's ample resources for both Wall Street to earn its outlandish bonuses and to make themselves feel good about themselves that way, and for you to earn something of a return too, then you both win. When there aren't sufficient resources for both, guess what happens? Wall Street gets its bonuses anyway, and there's nothing left over for you. And I think we're pretty close to that moment in time here. And it's a fancy way of saying real conflicts of interest. You know, the people who work in the financial industry are often deeply conflicted in terms of what they can say, what they can't say. They have fiduciary responsibilities that sometimes limit them from telling you about the entire universe of opportunities. You know, I know people who have been, even as recently as last week, cautioned by their broker not to go anywhere near gold. It's a silly investment. It's not an investment. It doesn't have any returns, et cetera. So there's just I think the first stage of awareness for me was understanding the extent to which Wall Street's interests and my own interests were not aligned, not even remotely aligned.
That's extremely well said, Chris, and I think that's a key point, what you just described, that the conflict of interest, and also that there's just no payoff in trusting Wall Street to look out for our money. And I think another topic about that makes it unconventional, at least in my view, is that the issue of sustainability and resilience, which is a topic that you know, you've addressed in depth on chrismartinson.com. So it will be familiar to most of your readers and listeners, but I think the solution here going forward is to have a number of income streams to increase the resilience of your household by having several income streams, which means having an enterprise or enterprises in which you are an owner or a major investor.
Mm-hmm. I'm particularly enamored with the idea that energy is going to be going up in price, or let's say as a fraction of our disposable income as we go forward.
Yeah.
You know, price is a relative thing. And so as that heads up over time, we're going to be discovering that the entire landscape changes. I find a very useful thought exercise is to ask myself the question, well, what changes in my life happen when gas goes to $10 a gallon? Well, I can tell you I'll be taking a lot fewer of trips, you know, just sort of, you know, at a whim to go do something. I'll be thinking about consolidating those. I'll be taking far fewer trips farther away because those will become more expensive, or I'll think them through more carefully. At $20 a gallon, something, you know, even more profound happens. And that's where we discover, once we play that thought experiment, all the places that you probably aren't going to go to personally anymore, those are places that aren't going to do all that well, is one way to look at it. There are going to be exurbs, distant strip malls, certain economic arrangements that just don't make sense under a much higher energy cost than we currently have. And so those are the things that fall away. And then, as you're implying here, there are things, though, that arise because now we're more local, and people are still going to have energy needs. We all still want to be warm when we want to be warm and cool when we want to be cool. And there are lots of opportunities to reconfigure our lives around that new reality. Now, where I live in New England, wood seems to be our only local natural energy source besides the sun. A little bit of hydro, but not enough to even write home about. So I'm looking at wood and saying, wow, you know, it was a very important energy source as recently as 100 years ago, and it probably will be again. And here's an opportunity for people who want to look at it that way. Unconventional, but something I can get my hands around. I understand it. It's local. I can look at it, touch it, and make sense of it.
Yeah, Chris, I think that's absolutely right, that each region will have a lot of enterprise opportunity. And I consider my book hopeful because I think that enterprise is completely possible in an era of declining resource consumption. In other words, just because we have to use less doesn't mean that there's no opportunity for investing in an enterprise. I think enterprise and investing are, in fact, are the solutions. And that if we withdraw our money from Wall Street and put it to use in our own communities and you know, to the benefit of our own income streams, then I think good things happen.
I completely agree. So let's sort of focus in on where enterprises might look. I'm interested, Charles, as you look at the current landscape and the financial markets, global credit system, geopolitics, maybe energy, whatever you're looking at, what do you see as the macro trends that will define how these next 10, 20 years are going to play out?
I would start with the four Ds, I call them, like deglobalization. I think that we're now seeing we're past the apex of globalization due to cheap energy and the sort of smoothing of corporate profits as the key metric of economic, quote, growth. I think that we're going to see a lot of nations starting to cut off access and flow of capital and resources to protect their own resources from exploitation by outside corporations. And I think we might even see that in the United States, that where people will say, gosh, maybe we shouldn't be selling our coal to China, or we shouldn't be selling our property to country XYZ. So deglobalization will, I think, radically change people's understanding of value and risk assessment. And then delegitimization, the loss of credibility of key institutions. People will realize they can no longer trust the savior state, what I call it, the central state, to meet all their needs and do what it had promised all these decades. And that institutions that people have relied on as trustworthy will be revealed as either corrupt or incompetent. And so that I think, will play out over the next couple decades as well. Decentralization.
Mm-hmm.
I think the whole idea that like centralized concentrations of wealth and expertise that we call corporations, with super long, fragile supply chains to one or two factories on the planet that are, quote, efficient, I think that whole system is going to unravel and devolve. And so we'll be seeking, in terms of as investors, the safety and lowering the risk element will be to choose local decentralized assets and income streams. So I think those are key dynamics of the next 10, 20 years.
And was there a fourth D? So far we had deglobalization.
Yeah.
And delegitimization and decentralization.
It was probably a shorthand for degrowthization. In other words, that there's no way that we're going to keep exploiting resources at an ever-increasing rate.
Great. How about deceleration then?
Deceleration. I love it.
All right. That sounds good because that's how I see it. It's not possible to continue to increase the rate of extraction and consumption of many things. And so as that rate falls, this is the uncomfortable period we're in. One of the big macro trends is, of course, we have all of our high priests and priestesses of money over there waving their magic wands, pressing the magic keyboard, making trillions appear out of thin air. That's supposed to work. And guess what? In a world of abundant and essentially unlimited resources, the limiting factor is the number of people available to work to extract them. Once you pass that threshold, it turns out that the waving the magic money wands doesn't do what it used to do. And it's very confusing, I'm sure, to everybody who's been inculcated in that system. They grew up in it. It's all they studied. They understand all of their differential equations around how the economy is supposed to work. They get the Taylor's rule and, interest rate spreads, and they get all that, and they put all that in, and they wave their wands, and the potion doesn't work, and it must be horribly confusing. And over here on the side, people who see this other point of view say, well, that's what we would kind of predict would happen if we took the amount of available net energy, that is the energy left over after we invest some energy to go find some. We take that net energy, and whether we sell it for dollars or just handed it out for free, wouldn't matter. Society will go off and do awesome things with that energy. As that stream of energy shrinks down, the complexity theory will tell you that any complex system owes its order and its ultimate complexity to the amount of energy coming through it. And once you decrease that energy flow, it'll become simpler. Well, what's simpler shorthand for? Well, fewer job types, fewer job specializations, fewer stock keeping units, fewer whatever you want, but ultimately they're units of economic activity. And so as you throw more money into fewer units of economic activity, that's where I think economics textbooks can tell you what will happen next with reasonable assurance. And that's that hidden default you talked about, otherwise known as inflation. That's one of the macro trends I have an eye firmly fixed on, is the idea that we are printing money at pretty rapid, if not the fastest rates ever seen, and shoving that into a world where I see less and less units of economic activity happening. And that's just, it's a chaotic system, so we can't predict all the wrinkles. We don't know where every grain of sand is going to fall in this story. But predicting that the sand tower is going to crumble is an easy one.
Yes, absolutely. I remembered the fourth D, which I had, which was definancialization, which is exactly what you're describing, which is the idea that we can financialize resources in some way that will make them, larger. That's over. Just because we print more money doesn't mean we're going to have more oil.
Right.
Yeah, and so one of the concepts in my book that kind of follows from this is if we're entering a period of definancialization, then what we want, of course, is real assets. And, of course, precious metals are the ultimate hedge, and they serve an essential role as that. But I'm not wealthy enough to, sell off part of my precious metals every month to buy food and stuff, So I'm kind of focused on how can I get income streams, what can I do in terms of social capital to set up a network of businesses and people I know and that I can trust and value, where I can sell my labor for anything. I can sell it for, a quarter ounce of gold or, equivalent amount of wheat or, whatever it is. My labor will have the same value as to what it can buy. And if I have an orchard, which I know how to, actually take care of my trees, then the harvest will have a value irrespective of how we measure that. And so I'll have an income stream, whether it's measured in wheat, gold, rent, a new fiat currency from Mars that's, whatever we have. And so that's kind of the focus of my book, is to look at how we can invest in income streams.
Yeah, I think it's very wise and sad that we have to, that we find ourselves here, because the money of a nation, the money of a people, it's an agreement. It's ultimately an agreement between ourselves. And so therefore it's a social contract. You know, that's what money really is. Forget it's supposed to be a store of value and unit of account and all those other textbook things. Those are sort of features, right? But what it really is to me is this social agreement. And so you and I agree that this piece of paper is worth $10 and this piece of paper is worth $20 and that piece of paper is just a newspaper, you know? So we have these agreements around what these things are worth. And what you're describing is that as we lose faith in that agreement, a lot of things in our social contract begin to fray. And in that scenario, one of the things we might consider doing is understanding what really intrinsic value actually is. An apple has intrinsic value regardless of how many pieces of paper we decide it's worth or agree upon. It's still an apple. And an apple still has a relative intrinsic value compared to an hour of labor potentially, or wheat or whatever. So you're actually talking about walking away from the money itself simply due to a loss of faith. Is that a fair characterization?
Well, Chris, I think you very well described that the loss of trust as a social contract. And that, so one way of looking at this is capital is not just financial, it's social, what we call social capital. And that is, in fact, the valuation of trust. And so if you have a lot of social capital, what that's another way of saying is, you know, people you can trust, you have an enterprise that has a trustworthy output and trustworthy sources of inputs. And so what we're really talking about is revaluing trust away from, say, paper money and the institutions that rely on that.
Yeah, you know, this is a really important point to me. And, I critique the Fed a lot in terms of their actual actions, but my largest critique of them is that they're ultimately operating a fiat money system of which confidence and trust are the two most important characteristics. We have to have trust that they're not going to overproduce this stuff, confidence that they're going to wisely manage it. And so when the Fed blocks every single effort for people to peer into that public balance sheet and ask the very legitimate question, what's on there? Who did you buy it from? What did you pay for it? What are your plans for disposing of it? And then we find out through a FOIA request years after the fact that the Fed basically supported every country, company, bank in the world that needed access to dollars without any regard to the trust or the confidence pieces. They are, in my mind, playing with real fire here because they're eroding the most important feature of any money, which is the trust people have in its stability, in its utility, in its store of value characteristics, in all of these pieces. This is why I think this really describes to me much of the social angst, even of people who don't quite understand all the mechanisms and the arcana and the jargon around what the Fed does or doesn't do. They just know in their heart somehow that printing up $600 billion to buy treasury bills out of thin air, that there's just something wrong with that. And I think it's the trust that gets eroded that creates that anxiety. What are your thoughts?
I agree, Chris, and it's what I call the de-legitimization process, that the legitimacy of these institutions is being eroded, as you say. And the Fed has already lost a tremendous amount of credibility. I think that politically it is already mortally wounded, in my mind, because people realize that printing of $600 billion, the QE2, was a complete, utter, total failure. It did not help the economy. It did not help the citizens. It failed. And so the Fed has failed. And I think that people's faith in the Fed's, godlike status has been taken down considerably. And I think the same can be said of Congress, the banking sector. I mean, just a huge number of institutions are failing, and people are recognizing that, and they're losing credibility. And so I think the answer is not to get depressed about it, but to relocalize the institutions that we can trust, which is tends to be like our city council, and the organizations that form our communities.
Right. So I agree with that, and I don't really know how to counsel individuals to change the macro system. I look at it and say, just looking through the energy lens alone, I see that every energy transition we've ever had in history took 40 to 60 years. So we went from wood to coal, from coal to oil, you know, and so on. Each one of those took a long time, and there's a really good reason for that, right? You know, you have all this invested and embedded capital in the old energy structure, and you have to, it takes time for that stuff to wear out and get replaced through normal mechanisms. And I look at our current environment, and I say, okay, we have an enormous energy challenge coming before us, and we haven't taken any steps to really seriously address that. Cash for Clunkers was more of a joke than a serious sort of effort at that. Our fuel standards are still something of a joke at the pace at which we're going to put them on. We don't really have mass transit now. There's no energy policy I can look at and say, wow, that squares up with reality. And so that's just one example, one slice, where I'm looking at current leadership and saying, I don't see any leadership in terms of what to me would be a credible adult-sized response to just the energy slice of this story. But there are other slices here in terms of what we're doing with the deficit and how we're going to manage the entitlement programs, or what we're really doing around education or infrastructure, or, you know, the fact that we think nothing of spending $1 trillion on making sure our banks are healthy, but we can't seem to find the money to invest in what I consider to be legitimate alternative technologies or the next wave of farming that doesn't involve, you know, big agribusiness and, you know, involves permaculture and other practices that are legitimate and sustainable and understandably sustainable. So that's the delegitimization I see, is that almost all of the actions that I see, I can only really understand and support if what I'm trying to do or what they're trying to do is perpetuate the status quo. They're doing a great job at that. I just don't have any faith, any trust that the status quo is either desirable or sustainable at this point. And so that's why I am personally very much out of step with the current machinery as it's architected and running. And that's why I don't spend any time trying to change it or tell people how to change it. I'm glad people do, and they put a lot of energy there. My energy and focus is on helping individuals, companies, communities figure out what they can do under the idea that that somebody's going to have to manage their future, and it's probably going to be them.
I think that's a terrific encapsulation of where we are, and that we have to solve our own problems. That the savior state and these institutions are not going to reform themselves, and they're not reformable in any way that's meaningful. And so, I think what we're talking about is taking your capital, which is your human capital, your skills and your experience, your social capital, the people you know, the trust that you've created in life, and your financial capital, and investing them in local solutions, you know, things that people need, like energy, food, shelter, and a low energy lifestyle. Like, as you said, perhaps the most significant investment someone can make is to move into a sustainable community where they can walk or bike or, you know, ski to everything they need, you know, within a few kilometers, a few miles.
Absolutely. I have been counseling for a long time that anything that individuals can do to, and this would apply to companies as well, anything you can do to make an investment today that will reduce your cash flow that you put towards energy, in particular food, secondarily, those will be incredible investments. You can often make a perfectly valid economic argument for them under today's energy prices. And if you just wiggle the spreadsheet a little bit and ask the question, what happens when energy prices are 50% or 100% higher or something worse, these investments just become absolute no-brainers. There's no other return on capital you're going to find in today's investing environment that even matches some of these opportunities. You know, we can do that on pure economic terms, but then you also have increased your resilience. And if you have multiple avenues of meeting your heating needs, for instance, then if any one of them fails, you have backups. And so this makes sense on so many dimensions. And the one that really helps me out is I actually sleep better because I've made these investments. Not that I feel good about being greener or anything like that. That's not a big motivator for me. What is a big motivator is the idea that I have more control over my energy, and I am expending, I have less cash flow going out for it, and that I am less tied to and dependent on these systems over which I have no control to deliver to me what I feel like I need to live a good, comfortable lifestyle. At the bottom of that list, yes, these things are greener, and that helps too, but that's not my prime motivator.
Yeah, and you know, that raises an excellent point, Chris, is that there is opportunity for technological innovation, say, in greatly increasing the efficiency of our appliances and the rest of our lifestyle, but and as well as tremendous technological improvements in production and so on. But there's also what we might call social and behavioral innovations, which the United States is really poor at even recognizing.
Mm-hmm.
And that, you know, the simplest way to cut your energy is to live close to the things that you need to get to. And if you have your own enterprise, then we might benefit, you know, on a household and on a social scale of, like, just living close to your job. And so, and so being dependent on corporate America and a job 100 miles away, that's a really fragile, vulnerable lifestyle. So if you can relocalize your income streams and your enterprises and live close to work and school, you know, you're already tremendously more resilient and have a much more sustainable, you know, household regardless of what happens.
Yeah, so we're really talking an issue of lifestyle. You know, I'm very fond of saying that my standard of living has fallen by quite a lot over the past few years, but my quality of life has gone up. These are not connected topics to me. So I'm interested, you know, you weave a lot of social themes into your economic observations and analyses, and you're one of the most thoughtful bloggers I follow. I want to get your thoughts on this idea of needing to choose between growth and prosperity. They've been linked for a long time. You know, we've always had both, and I think they've been conflated, and they're actually separate ideas in my mind. So it looks like growth is less and less likely, but what does this imply for ourselves in terms of prosperity? You know, do we necessarily have to settle for less? Or if not, what is that definition of prosperity we should be striving for?
I think that's an excellent question, Chris, which is rarely, if ever, asked. And I would start by saying that if we look at what the source of happiness is, both from studies, you know, academic studies, and from our own intuition, we find that that happiness comes from, of course, having enough to eat and a warm place to sleep. But those are actually rather modest. They're not that difficult to supply, you know. But happiness mostly flows from having positive goals and the opportunity to express your personality in a productive way. And we have linked this with the idea of a, quote, job, like you're going to go work for, you know, the government or corporate America, and you're going to find some satisfaction because you're making a lot of money. But that actually is the wrong path to prosperity. That prosperity is actually like a healthy life, if you will, which includes, like, having productive work that you control and a modest amount of the comforts of life, you know. But, and the freedom to express yourself. This is actual prosperity, and the amount of energy that requires is considerably less than the sort of bogus corporate America savior state mentality where, you know, the more money you have and the more resources you're squandering, the happier you're supposed to be. And of course, we all know that's false. We know lots of people who are wealthy and miserable.
Well, I think you could look at many cultural barometers and look at rates of incarceration, workplace violence, obesity. It doesn't matter, you know, psychoactive drug use in children under the age of 10. There's many things you could point to if you were from Mars and say, maybe not the best indicator of health, and maybe there's something worth looking into here. You know, one of my things that I really put into my definition of true prosperity, one of the things I really want for myself, for my kids, for everybody's kids, is the idea of living in peace and security and safety. The idea here for me that's troubling is that if we as a nation consider our rates of consumption to be a non-negotiable portion of our way of life, as Dick Cheney put it, then we're going to go to war for those resources if and when they become tight. And so that's one model, right? You say, wow, we want to have sufficient resources because our way of life is non-negotiable. Wow, we don't have sufficient resources. Somebody else has them. Well, we have to go to war because that's the narrative we have in play. And then you're describing a different one, which says, well, wait a minute. What if we could actually live just as meaningful? Wait, more meaningful lives on less stuff, and we don't have to go to war. Why wouldn't we choose that? And the people who are really running the narrative in our country right now haven't really started to even explore that avenue yet. And it's a concern for me. It's a concern for a lot of people. I will consider it a point of failure in my life if my kids get drafted into resource war with China because we just failed to do something as simple as get the story right. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, Chris, I completely concur, and I think that you you make a profound point that our individual and household consumption has geopolitical consequences, and that you and I both know that the 19 million barrels of oil a day we burn and the 11 million barrels a day we import could easily be cut in half with no reduction in the prosperity we're talking about, with just really modest improvements in efficiency and lifestyle. And so the idea, that's what really is depressing to me, is that we would inflict tremendous amount of harm and perhaps, as you say, even war to go get 8 million barrels a day of oil that we're just squandering. That, you know, could be cut with efficiencies, you know, that are not that difficult.
Yeah, I agree. That is that's a troubling side of this piece. And so I know that you're working as hard as diligently as you can to shift that story. I am too. A lot of people are. And so the hope I have is that there does seem to be a dawning awareness that it's time to really sit back and maybe take stock of where we are. And I see that happening at what I'm going to call the individual level, and that includes company level, but it's not yet happening on the political landscape. But that's okay, because you know what? Those people never lead. They always follow. And so our job is to create critical mass of awareness out here on the outside, and eventually Washington will wake up and go, we knew it all along. Allow us to lead you where you already are. And they'll be right there waving flags. It'll be an awesome thing to see. But in the meantime, do you have any final parting thoughts here for our listeners today?
Chris, I would say that it's my belief that enterprise is fun and that opportunity is there for the taking in remaking America and our lifestyle. I mean, it's like all open to us, and investing shouldn't be some kind of like worrisome, anxiety-producing drag. It should be part of who we are as people. In other words, investing in ourselves and in our community and in doing stuff that's exciting and fun.
I absolutely agree. That's very well said. So we're heading off into this uncertain future, and I would highly recommend people get an unconventional guide to investing in troubled times. Charles, how would they find that?
Right now it's a Kindle ebook on Amazon, and I will have a print edition later next month. But you can read a Kindle on any electronic device. The application to do so is free on Amazon.
Excellent. I've downloaded it. It works great. So we've been talking to Charles Hugh Smith. His primary blog is oftwominds.com. He's got a couple of books out there, and we've been talking about some of the topics in his most recent one. Charles, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Chris.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.